The Blaze Radio Network. On demand. Glenn
Beck. Right now in America, we're having a discussion of principles, or we should be having a discussion of principles, but sometimes it just turns into a discussion of teams. The principles that set America up as the great changing force of the world was freedom and the freedom to exchange with people. And it started with, really, can we be free to exchange between each other with the states? At the very beginning, the Articles of Confederation, the reason why it was too weak is everybody had their own money. People were charging different taxes and tariffs across the state borders. And we knew if we were going to be the United States, that wasn't going to work. We needed something. We needed to be able to trade with each other and just have and everybody will be on an equal footing. That's really one of the biggest problems of the Articles of Confederation and why we adopted the Constitution of the United States. Trade, free trade is in the marrow of our bones. But right now we're having a discussion that maybe we shouldn't have free trade. Maybe because of national interest or national security, we should have tariffs here, there, or elsewhere. And it's easy to win a trade war. Well, what is the principle behind free trade? Why is this important as a conservative principle?
Here to talk to us about that is Scott Linsicum. He's an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and an expert on free trade. Scott, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Scott, tell me in a nutshell. So let's start at macro. Why is this a fundamental conservative principle?
Sure. So I think there are a few reasons, really, but most basically, and you brought it up with respect to trade among the states, free trade really at its most basic is simply the absence of government in voluntary mutually beneficial transactions that just so happen to go across borders. Just as conservatives recoil at the thought of putting a bureaucrat between themselves and their doctors, you'd think they'd be similarly opposed to putting a bureaucrat between themselves and their merchants, for example. Now, beyond that simple principle, when you then look at what protectionism is on the other end of free trade, you see that protectionism is a hidden regressive tax on consumers who are forced by government to subsidize certain well-connected producers. And, the only difference between a tariff and a subsidy is that the tariff money comes right out of our own pockets instead of coming out of the Treasury. And this is kind of a classic bottom-up redistribution, and of one that actually hurts poorer Americans more than richer Americans, because poor Americans have, of course, smaller budgets to stretch in the first place.
Is there any difference between Illinois saying to Alabama, because Alabama got a new BMW plant and all the workers are going to go down there, and Illinois saying, you brought them in at an unfair advantage because you brought them in with tax incentives. And so anything that comes from Alabama, if you buy that BMW in Illinois, we're going to charge you a little bit more.
Right. No, there's not any sort of fundamental difference between the border between two states and the border between two countries. You can try to think of kind of nationalistic ideas, but the fact is, in terms of kind of the economics and the principles of it, you're really dealing with the same thing.
We doing that then by saying, I'm going to give Boeing a tax incentive by coming to this state? Isn't that, in a way, a subsidy? Why does it work with the states and it doesn't work with foreign countries?
I think one of the reasons is that we kind of recognize the value of the system of the free exchange of goods across borders when it comes to the states. And we don't think that, while we might not be thrilled with certain companies in certain states getting these subsidies, we understand that, first of all, their taxpayers are, in a way, subsidizing our consumption.
Yeah.
But second, that the system itself is so valuable that it's not worth destroying it just because we might not like what happens every once in a while, that there is kind of this greater importance to keeping the system alive. Now, when you change that to international boundaries, for some reason, that whole calculus goes out the window. And all of a sudden, foreign governments subsidizing our consumption is a big problem. We are far more willing to accept government interference in our transactions because of these vague kind of allegations of unfairness or whatever. Now, never mind that a lot of these allegations of unfairness are made by the foreign producers' domestic competition. And in fact, those are the guys who got to write our unfair trade laws, and those are the guys that you might imagine have a rather strong commercial interest in ensuring that we as consumers buy from them and not from their foreign competition.
There's been about three like main conversations, I feel like, going around this topic. I want to ask you about each of them. The first one, though, I think has been the least covered, which is, let's just say the argument for protectionism works. Let's just say it's a good idea for a moment. Yeah. Are the circumstances with the steel industry in particular even there to justify it if it did work?
Yeah, it certainly doesn't appear so. So if you look at steel production over the last several decades, it's pretty steady. There was, of course, a huge drop in the Great Recession, but over the last almost 10 years, steel output's been about 90 million tons. You also look at imports, and imports are still only about 25 to 27% of the market, so the U.S. industry still has over 70% of the domestic market share. You look at the company's profits, they're actually making hundreds of millions of dollars in profits right now. And then, of course, you look at the national security arguments here, which are what are being debated right now. Mm-hmm. And you look at most of our imports actually come from our closest allies, like Canada, for example, or Europe or Japan. These are countries with which we have security treaties. I mean, Canada, for heaven's sakes, is part of the American national defense industrial base defined by law.
So hang on just for a second, though.
Wow.
If we play this out, I mean, looking at World War II, we had the resources, we had the factories, and we could build these things.
Right.
If we were down to 10% steel, we were only making 10% of our own steel, you could make the case that a country to be strong has got to have these plants. But that's not the case in this.
Yeah, definitely. So, in fact, Secretary Mattis himself wrote a letter to the Department of Commerce, as was required under the statute we're dealing with right now. And he noted that only 3% of current Department of Defense needs could be satisfied. So only 3% of total domestic steel production could satisfy all of DOD's needs. So DOD only needs a tiny fraction of our actual U.S. steel output. Same goes for aluminum. So the idea that the steel that we have this withering steel industry, then we can't build tanks and planes and the rest, just simply is nonsense, as Secretary Mattis himself made clear.
All right, next question. Pretty much every president from both parties has always talked about and many times enacted tariffs on particularly steel. We've done it a million times. What were the results when we've done it?
Right. The results were not very good. So in a paper I wrote for Cato last year, I actually documented the long history of American protectionist failures. And steel features prominently. And if you look at over the years, over and over and over again, steel protectionism imposed immense costs on American consumers, and not just American families, but also a lot of American businesses and workers, manufacturers that need steel, construction companies that, of course, need steel. So not only did it impose immense costs, hundreds of thousands of dollars per year for any steel job saved or created, but also didn't even lead to the revitalization of the industry. So the industry still suffered bankruptcies. The industry still came back for even more protection. And so over and over again, you see that it just simply didn't work. And in fact, you see in some cases the industry refusing to innovate, refusing to reinvest, refusing to get lean and mean and competitive again, and instead relying on government protection.
It violates the Kondratiev wave.
So, Scott, because in one other part of this is you could argue that you can save a few steel jobs with a big tariff, right? But the overall effect on employment in America is actually negative with these things. Is that what you found?
Exactly. So if you look, for example, at the – so, of course, President Bush imposed steel safeguard tariffs back in 2001 and 2002. And the net result was the destruction of about 250,000 jobs, according to one report, 100,000 jobs in the other. I mean, the exact numbers don't matter. The fact is that you saw a net destruction of jobs overall. And that's just basic common sense, really, when especially in something like steel that's such a critical raw material. Steel workers in this country are outnumbered by steel consuming workers by something like 45-1. So it's inevitable that if you tax the inputs of these 45 to save the one, you're going to end up with more losses. And that's, of course, what happens over and over. And that's leaving out the kind of egg-heady economics on deadweight loss and the rest. I mean, just looking common sense at the common sense angle of it, you're going to end up with losses that far outweigh the gains.
So let me ask you the third question, and that is, trade wars are easy to win.
Right. The sad thing about a trade war is that everyone loses. You don't end a trade war emerging victorious. All you've really done is you end up, you're poorer. In fact, trade wars are simply when both sides yell across the ocean and then turn inward and shoot their own citizens. And that's really what happens over and over again. You know, as we tax imports of whether it be steel or automobiles, we simply harm American consumers. And, you know, foreign exporters will get hurt too, but you're taking a lot of casualties for that. And then, of course, if a foreign government retaliates, which many have promised to do in the case of the current steel and aluminum tariffs, then, of course, our exporters get hit, their consumers get hurt. And at the end of the day, everybody's just poorer and worse off. And when the thing finally ends, there is no real victor here.
So I want to take a quick break, and then I want to come back because there's I want you to make the case for the person who is just hardworking, is really struggling, sees jobs going overseas, sees their jobs not getting any better, and somebody saying, you know what, it's because we're being taken advantage of by Europe and China. And I want you to speak directly to that person when we come back.
It's Scott Linsicum from the Cato Institute, and it's nobody better. Nobody knows this topic better than Scott. You can read his – he just wrote a story for – he wrote referenced the paper from Cato. You can find it. We'll tweet it out at World of Stew and at Glenn Beck.
Glenn Beck.
Talking free trade in layman's terms on why this is a conservative principle, why it's an important American principle – And Scott, I want you to speak directly to the person who is not into global politics. They look at globalism and say, yeah, I want to be a part of the global community, but we're being ripped off and I'm struggling and I feel like our jobs are going overseas and nobody's protecting us. We're playing fair. The other parts of the world are not. It's time somebody stands up for me.
Right. So, you know, I think there are a lot of responses there. I mean, the first, of course, is that, you know, I think free traders generally need to be a bit more sympathetic to the concerns and fears of, you know, a lot of average Americans. You know, we're dealing right now in a very disruptive economic period. It's not just globalization, though. In fact, the vast majority of job losses, particularly in manufacturing, over the last few decades have come from automation and technological change than from trade. And, of course, there are changing consumer tastes that just simply we prefer services more these days than we do to certain manufactured goods and so forth. And so, you know, there is a necessary amount of sympathy that goes to kind of being in this very, very disruptive period. But again, it's important to note that this isn't just or even primarily a globalization thing. The second thing to note is, though, that the parts of disruption that are trade-related are really just manifestations of kind of free market competition, which we kind of all inherently understand are really good, and not just good, but important for our economy. And, you know, the American economy is this kind of dynamic, churning beast of sorts that if you start to slow that down, or if you start to prevent the adjustment that the economy kind of does naturally in a free market, if you start thwarting all of these great things that come from free market competition, we actually all will end up even worse off. And, you know, on trade, that's not just cheaper T-shirts. It's jobs, in whether it be trucking or ports or in, again, import-consuming manufacturing, in services, you name it. And all of this is overall a good thing. But look, that still doesn't help the guy whose job actually did get, you know, outsourced or mm-hmm. sent abroad. Mm-hmm. That's rough. But the again, it's a part of this kind of greater economic dynamism. And the other point, you know, oftentimes unmentioned is that, you know, if you have jobs that were literally that literally existed only because they were behind a tariff wall or because they were receiving a government subsidy, you know, you do of course have to ask the question about whether that subsidy or that tariff really should be staying in place in the first place. I mean, you know, you again are kind of dealing with this redistribution idea. Should some of us be forced to subsidize others? But you know, look, finally, there is an adjustment thing. You know, something that we talk about a lot is we really do need better policies in place when it comes to helping workers, helping individuals adjust. You know, we just have not updated our policies to reflect how disruptive an era
yes.
we have right now.
Yes.
And that, again, is not just trade. In fact, it's far
everything.
More about all these other things that
yeah.
are going on, and it's particularly information technology.
We have
and to have policies that are from the 1950s and 60s to help workers that are disrupted, displaced in 2018 really makes no sense. I think there really is a place for legitimate government action, or at least reform of our systems. You know, one of the things I love to talk about, the example I love to use, is that for a long time we had a tax credit for people who were training in their same job, but they couldn't get that exact same benefit for training for a new job.
That makes no sense in this sort of economy. Quick, Scott Litzicum, we have got about 30 seconds left, 40 seconds. One quick question I have for you. I read the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, to say the Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations. Yet we're talking about this as if the Congress can't do anything to stop these tariffs. What's the process of this?
Right. So because Congress has over the years delegated so much of its trade powers to the president, you're really looking now that Congress would have to act. It would have to pass some sort of legislation, and I guess it would have to be veto-proof legislation. Now, that said, there's history for this. Under this very same law, Congress in 1980 actually did pass a law against a president of its own party. And then overrode the veto. So there is potential for action, and Congress does have the constitutional authority to do so. But more broadly, we really need to have a talk about whether the trade powers delegated to the president still make sense in today's economy,
Scott,
but not only in today's economy, with today's president.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it. Adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, and probably the leading authority on trade and why free trade is something we should all be a champion of.
Glenn Beck.
Mercury.
Program. Stu, I don't know what's wrong with us. We just talked about steel, and we were not wearing a hard hat. I don't know if you've seen all of the people on location, all of the reporters that are talking about steel. They're all wearing hard hats now.
That is true.
And
I will
say,
I did roll my sleeves up for that last segment.
Did you?
If you weren't watching on television.
Yeah. I'm wearing a denim shirt today.
Oh, okay.
I could have had a hard hat. I could have looked like a man today.
We were pretty hard workers here. Lots of calluses on our hands. This is
Natasha,
difficult work.
I need at least two hard hats in the studio at all times in case we need to talk about trade. tariffs are steel. Okay, thank you.
Okay, good.
All right.
Pat, you're not wearing your hard hat.
I just
either.
Want to mention, though, that I've got permanent calluses on a couple of my fingers, and I have no idea why. I've never done an ounce of hard work in my life. I don't know where they came from.
You actually have permanent calluses?
I do, yeah.
Do you really?
I've known you for 40 years. Yeah.
The only hard work you've ever done is like...
I pushed a few buttons.
When car doors were heavy and you had to open them.
Right, yeah. Right. If the butler didn't do it first,
yeah.
Right?
Butler, yeah. I don't know. My hands are baby soft. I've never
I know.
Done
I, it's, I don't know why I have them.
I go out.
I do.
You know what's
kind
really,
of proud of them, actually.
What's really funny is you go out to farm or something. You do something and you don't have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you love it. And you're like, this is great. You know, hard work, man, it just really makes you feel good. And you just, it just means something. But if you actually have to do it, it's awful.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The minute mm-hmm. I would have to farm my land, right. I love being the farmer that I am because I'm only up and I'll plow the fields and I'll cut the hay and everything else. But I don't have to. Mm-hmm. And the minute I say, I'm done, I just turn the tractor off, walk away, go, I'm done for the day. That's the way hard work is fun.
Well, I think people that listen to this show recognize that I'm the real American here.
Yeah.
You know, you guys both started in radio very young.
Yeah.
Now, I've had difficult manufacturing type jobs.
Have you?
I was an assistant spot welder for a summer.
Assistant spot welder?
Oh, yeah. Assistant
really?
Spot welder. Which basically wow. meant, it, like, if you picture, like, a spot welder, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a big sheet of metal,
mm-hmm.
and it's sitting up on a table,
mm-hmm.
and then, but they need to kind of move it. And what I would do is I would get under the table, and they would do the spot weld above my head, and then sparks would fall on me.
Right.
That was basically the job.
Did you have to have a hard hat?
I did. I actually wore
oh
a hard
gosh,
hat.
Oh, my gosh. You had a job with a hard hat.
But, I mean, it sucked. I hated it. It was 100 degrees, and there were sparks mm-hmm. in my face all
but
the
wait,
time.
But wait. If you were doing that because you were going to make a metal table yourself.
Right.
You'd be out there and be oh, like, this yeah. is the greatest.
That's what people are like, oh, I want to restore old cars. Yeah, unless you have to restore all cars
yeah,
every day,
yeah.
you want to restore old cars.
When we actually had no money to buy cars and they were breaking down all the time, we didn't want to restore it. Mm-mm. We wanted a new one.
Right.
Do you remember the days when you could just reach behind the instrument panel and you could unplug the check engine light?
Oh, yeah.
And you would do that because I'm not fixing it, and I'm tired of looking at it, so I just unplug the damn thing.
That's the best solution.
Yeah. Now the check engine light comes on, and you're like, oh, crap.
Yeah. Well, now you can't even have access to the battery anymore.
No.
It's all covered, at least on my car.
It is.
All of it.
You don't put... I've had to jump, you know, my car a couple times, which is about as deep into car repair as I can go. And
that's not car repair.
It's not? Okay.
No.
But... Now the two places you put the thingies, you know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I'm getting technical here. If you're not a car
yeah,
person,
the places
you,
you put the thingies.
The places you put the thingies are not next to each other on the battery anymore.
I noticed
there's
that.
There's one like in one place, and then you got to reach down underneath the car to a completely different section of the engine block.
No, I don't
block.
Like that. Absolutely there might be ridiculous. Things down there that could cut your fingers off.
That's what I think.
right. You never know.
That's why I go on my phone. I just go Uber,
and then I just don't drive
for a month
Triple
or so.
Triple A.
Yeah. My car doesn't work.
When Tanya bought me, she bought this old truck, 1957, and the engine is huge, but it just looks like there's nothing to it. You know what I mean? It's not. Mm-hmm. It's all open.
Yeah.
You can get to any side, and the mm-hmm. truck is so damn big that you could probably almost stand next to the engine in between. You know, inside under the hood, you could almost stand in there. And so when we first got it, I know nothing about cars. And so Rafe and I were looking at it, and he jumped up on the bumper and he was looking into the engine. And I was telling him, you know, I think these are the cylinders in here. I think this is, I'm pretty sure. And these are the spark plugs. And then we got underneath the car and we were just laying there and we were just looking up at it. And he was like, what's that? And I'm like, no idea. What's that? I think that maybe turns the wheels. I'm not really. I don't.
Turns the wheels.
I'm not really sure.
It's a defibrillator.
We ended up spending like 40 minutes just laying underneath the car, And Tanya came out and she said, "What the hell are you guys doing?" And I said, "We're just learning about the truck." She said, "Neither of you know anything about it. Get up." But there was something about laying underneath the car and pretending that we did. Mm-hmm. That was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But I contend if I actually would have had to fix that truck and there was nobody else to fix it, it wouldn't have been a fun experience with me and my son.
I would have
come out with a finger that was bleeding. And I would have thrown, not that wrench. I would have been saying things at that level to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, people glorify, you know, like sort of romanticize, I guess is the right word, of manufacturing jobs. And it's like, well, you know, anyone losing their job, you don't want to lose your income, right? It doesn't mean that we should glorify manufacturing jobs as this thing that we want the entire economy to be based on in the future and make sure all of them return.
For instance,
I'd rather have it, I mean, I think most people would rather have, if they had a choice between a manufacturing job and a job where they flap their fat mouth for 3 hours on radio, they're probably going to pick this one. Why? Because mm-hmm. you don't have to freaking get dirty. You don't have to get sweaty. You don't have to know what the hell you're doing. There's lots of benefits of this game.
And two out of the three have no calluses on their hands, and the one who does has no idea how they appeared.
This is a really good thing, actually. Yeah. That's a good thing. Yeah. I like
manly
it.
Manly men talk on that program.
But you know what's interesting is if you look at the stats that we went over yesterday, what is it, 60 or 80% of jobs now are white collar in America. Mm. That is a huge difference and something that we all would have said is really, really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, yeah, sure. That used mm-hmm. to be, they used to say, oh, you know what, these low paying jobs. Now they're saying, because manufacturing jobs has a really good political sort of connotation to it.
Yeah.
You're talking about things, because it's like what you were talking
about. You're talking about people who, men who actually look like men.
Yeah, men who, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's a great, it's also though a,
but they're jobs people complained about, right?
Yeah, people
when they
hated
had them.
Yeah, I mean, my dad
I work
had
in a factory my whole life, and you think, oh, dang it, I'm sorry.
Right, like you get it was right? something. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was.
They complained about it,
and there's a nostalgia related to it, just like you were talking about fixing cars. It's like we kind of like that. You get your hands dirty, you get in there, but it's a picture.
It's not a job you want your whole life.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, you wind up with long-term problems. Why do you think unions are always complaining that they need larger healthcare plans and better pensions and things? It's not just because, you know, there are legitimate health problems that arise from many of those jobs. They're difficult freaking jobs.
My grandfather didn't have a finger. My grandfather had a finger cut off in a job that he had. And it was just like, oh, yeah, I just lied. It was no big deal. I just lied. I mean, that's the way it used to be.
I know. You know what I mean?
I was out with the tractor and we were, I don't know what it is, but you got a spiky thing that goes off the side and it kind of fluffs up the hay. Sure, that's not what it's.
Farmer Glenn, is that you?
Yeah, it's me. It's mm-hmm. me. So we were fluffing the hay.
Fluffing the hay?
We were fluffing the hay. And I have no idea
what you're talking about.
Absolutely
right now.
Okay. No idea. I know why we do it. I just don't know what it's called.
Okay.
Okay. So we're fluffing the hay.
You sound like every liberal on guns right now.
I know, right? I know. Good thing is there's only about five farmers left in America. I can't remember, it's been a few years. Something got tangled up because the alfalfa it can start to get caught up in this like fluffer thing.
Mm-hmm. Fluffer, okay. This is not a good conversation.
Right. So you know, you get out and you're immediately looking at it and you're like, okay, I've got to, but it's stopped. And if you don't turn the fluffer off, mm-hmm. it's just jammed. And you've got your hands and arms in there. And if the fluffer starts to fluff again, it's going to rip your arms off.
That's why farming is one of the most dangerous jobs you can have.
It is. And it's when you don't have a farmhand that you go, hey, the fluffer is stuck. And then he gets out, and then you're logically just sitting there going, I don't know what to do. But you see him reach in. That's when you say, should I turn the fluffer off? And he's like, you didn't turn it off? Now, this is a very specific hypothetical situation. Right. But it could happen.
I have no idea if what you're saying makes any sense, but I cannot hear it in the context you mean it. I cannot. And it's not helpful.
All right.
Pat, mm-hmm. rescue us from this.
I'm excited about Sunday night. Are you guys going to watch the OJ confession?
If I remember.
If I guys
have to call remember.
You have to call me. I won't remember.
Oh, you have to remember. It's 7 o'clock Central, so 8 Eastern. And this is the one that was done, what, 10, 12 years ago? When they wrote the book, If I Did It, Here's How It Happened.
Do we know why that book wasn't released?
Yes. Yeah, because the Goldmans were pissed, and they stopped it.
And they were like, hey, maybe you shouldn't be making millions of dollars off our kid's murder.
Yeah.
So it became such a controversy at the time.
And so whoever did it in the first place, I think it was Fox, wasn't it, that shelved it? And so now they're bringing it back out after all this time and putting it on the air.
And they're putting it on the air now because, nobody cares about the Goldmans anymore.
Is that what it is? Yeah. It's been long enough now.
Yeah.
I guess. Okay. So they're going to play it. And he goes through this hypothetical and he starts speaking hypothetically. And then all of a sudden it turns first person. And it's chilling when he does because he starts talking about his friend Charlie that came over to his house. And he said to me, in the words of OJ, he said to me, OJ, you're not going to believe what's going on over at Nicole's house. And he said, whatever is going on, it's got to stop.
Do we have the audio of that?
We have the, I think we have the trailer of it.
Here it is.
Play a little bit.
In 2006, OJ Simpson gave a no-holds-barred interview, including his gripping account of what might have happened that fateful night. For over a decade, the tapes of that infamous interview were lost. Until now.
Lost.
I'm going to tell you a story you've never heard before. It takes place the night of June 12, 1994, and it concerns the murders of my ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her young friend, Ronald Goldman. Forget everything you think you know about that night, because I know the facts better than anyone.
Well, I bet you do.
I bet he does.
This is one story the whole world got wrong.
Does he confess? You be the judge. O.J. Simpson. The Lost Confession.
I said
Sunday,
lost.
March 11th.
It wasn't lost.
Fox.
It was sitting in some vault someplace, and somebody was licking their chops going, oh, my gosh.
Is it time yet?
It's time now, isn't it?
Now that he's out, they can actually play this, I guess. I mean, it's amazing because he does do it in a first person.
Mm-hmm. But wasn't that the point of the book?
Yes, but what a weird point. It's one of the strangest things in American history.
Well, because he starts talking like, if it happened, here's how it might have happened. But then he switches to, I did this, and he said this to me. And it's a chilling kind of switch into first-person speak where it sounds like he's talking about what he did.
Yeah, I mean, can you
imagine
what
he actually did?
Can you imagine going to someone who was accused of a crime, and his freedom, you know, is dependent on the idea that he did not commit it, and going to him and saying, hey, would you write a book describing a hypothetical way that you'd commit the crime you're accused of? What would possibly motivate you other than the fact that you did do it and you believe you wanted to confess for some reason, either money or for to get it off your chest, but you knew you couldn't do it without going to prison? This is your way of confessing it.
I just want to also point out it's worse than that. It is, imagine your wife has been killed. A brutal, brutal killing. You are busy looking for the killer.
On every golf course in America.
People think that you've done it.
Yeah.
What would possess you? And you would be, you would say, that's obscene.
Of course.
Yeah.
If I remember, I am going to definitely watch this on Sunday night.
If you remember.
Well, you might be out fixing old cars in the garage.
Well, not fixing, exactly.
Was sitting under them.
Yeah.
You need to put a flat screen underneath the car.
Got one because the car doesn't work because I have no idea how to fix it.
Glenn Beck.
They think that they may have found Amelia Earhart. And don't get excited, she's not doing well.
I didn't think she was alive.
Well, I didn't know. I just, you know, cat's on the roof. Anyway, new scientific study shows that the bones found in 1940 on a Pacific island now belong to Earhart. They said that in 1941, these were not her bones. They now have done it again, and they've said that these are. It looks, I don't know the full story. We'll have to get this tomorrow. But they found a woman's shoe. They found a sextant there. They found herbal liqueur. And, you know, this is a better ending for her, I think, being a possible castaway on this island. Then the other theory is that she was captured by the Japanese and tortured to death because they thought she was an American spy. But we'll give you the full story tomorrow because it's pretty remarkable.
Glenn Beck. Mercury.